In his new book, the writer Jonathan Thompson traces the various arcs in the history of San Juan County, Utah. He goes back before it was anything approaching a county, when it was a thriving settlement of indigenous people. And then he moves it forward to the time Mormon settlers arrived with this sense of entitlement to the land. There were these turning points in the story that punctuated this evolution, the creation of national parks, the passing of environmental laws. You had the Reagan administration and deregulation on one hand. You had the Obama administration and the designation of Bears Ears on the other. At one point in the book, he tells a story from another one of these turning points. This was April of 2017. Donald Trump hadn't been in office all that long and already was promising to shrink Bears Ears, so the tension in the county was pretty high. The story involves a retired couple from Durango, Colorado, Rose Chilcote and Mark Franklin. They had decided to go camping on April 1st in San Juan County in a place called Valley of the Gods.
Rose had been the associate director of a group called Great Old Broads for Wilderness, and a lot of their advocacy work occurred in San Juan County, Utah. And part of it was to advocate for the designation of Bears Ears National Monument, and a lot of it had to do with grazing on public lands. They were very active in trying to remove cows from some public lands and getting more responsible grazing practices in other parts. Meanwhile, her husband, Mark Franklin, he is a retired graphics designer who had mostly worked for public lands agencies. And Mark Franklin, he had to take a leap. So he pulled off on a road in Valley of the Gods, and the first pull off on that gravel road was next to a corral. And there was a gate on it, and the gate was open. So he got out and did his business. And he was looking at this corral, and there were these cows in there. And there was also, on the other side of the corral, there was an opening that was about the same size as the gate. And so, basically, cows could come in and go as they pleased. And he was curious about something, so he kind of wandered into the corral, and it was a big tractor tire. And they had made it so it would hold water so that the cows could drink out of it. And once his curiosity was satisfied, he started walking away. But then he noticed that the cows were kind of giving him this evil eye and were kind of moving towards him. And so when he got to the gate, he closed the gate. And the cows could still get in and out. There was another opening in the corral. But he walked back to the car, and Rose was like, "Why did you close that gate? What's wrong with you? Why can't you just leave things alone?" And he was sort of like, "I don't know. I just did. You know, it was whatever. I don't know. It's just what I do." And so they dropped it. They drove away. They went out. They camped for a few days. Had a wonderful time. And then they broke camp and they were leaving. And Rose, who, as I mentioned, worked with people who were kind of watchdogs of public land grazing, she had noticed these earthen berms that had been built in arroyos to capture water so that cows could drink from the water. And it seemed to her that they were in a wilderness study area where you shouldn't be able to do that kind of work. And she wanted to take some pictures to document it and perhaps report it. And when they came to that road where the corral was, Rose said, "Hey, Mark, you know, can you pull off on this road? Because I think I saw another one of these constructions, these dams, down this road when we were there before. So can you go down there?" So they did, and they drove past the corral. And when they drove past the corral, they noticed that some people were working there. No big deal. They didn't think anything of it. They went past the corral. They went to this other earthen berm and took some pictures of it. And then they got back in the car and they drove back down the road. But as they were coming towards the corral, they noticed these two cowboys running across the desert from the corral towards the road, almost like they were in a race. And then they notice this flatbed truck coming behind them, almost ran the two cowboys over. And there's like jacks and shovels flying off it because they're driving just cross country. And the flatbed truck comes into the county road and parks sideways in the middle of the road, blocking Rose and Mark's progress. So they had no choice but to stop. And Mark got out and said, "What the heck is going on here?" And the two cowboys who were running, they eventually caught up. And the guy who was driving the flatbed truck, he gets out and they start kind of yelling about how they had finally caught them and they had got them and they're not going to get away now. And the sheriff's going to really get you and all this stuff. Mark and Rose didn't have any idea what was going on. At one point, Rose got out of the car and was like, "Okay, something's going on here. These people are detaining us for no reason. I'm going to take some pictures of them." And she started taking pictures. And when she did, they said, "We've got video of you closing the gate. We know you tried to kill our cows." That's when she got scared and she got back inside the car, and they were relieved that a law enforcement agent was going to come, because that means that they weren't going to be the victims of some kind of vigilante justice out in the desert, you know? And it was about then that Mark kind of realized sort of what was going on. He remembered that he had closed the gate. He said, "Oh yeah, I closed the gate. You know, that's what I do. I was trying to help out." They didn't take too kindly to that. So they waited, and pretty soon the sheriff's deputy showed up. And the cowboys were saying that Mark had closed the gate and had done it intentionally and was trying to cut the cows off from their water. And the deputy was sort of like, "Yeah, okay." And he was asking Mark, "Did you shut the gate?" And he said, "Yeah, I shut the gate." And he said, "Well, did you know that you were cutting them off from water?" And he said, "I didn't cut them off from water because the other side of the corral was open. There was this opening, and there still is." And in fact, there still was. And the deputy asked Mark and Rose their names and got their information, and he sent them on their way. A few days later, Rose writes a letter to the BLM laying out, A, that there's these earthen berms and there's been construction and dirt moving inside a wilderness study area. And so she's pointing that out. And B, that these ranchers, who she believes were probably the allotment holders on BLM land, had detained her and basically harassed her. And that doesn't seem like something that allottees should be doing. And then maybe 10 days later, they get notice from the San Juan County District Attorney that they are being charged with a number of felonies, including the wanton attempt to harm or kill livestock, criminal trespassing, and also with attempting to intimidate a witness because of the letter to the BLM. Basically, if they were found guilty, they both could spend a serious amount of time in jail, as well as paying some massive fines. So this set off what has come to be known as Gategate, which was this long legal skirmish that still is not over yet today. And no matter how you look at it, the charges that the county brought down on these two people, in some way they were politically motivated. I believe that it was just another escalation, another volley in the battle over public lands in San Juan County. And you can call it the Sagebrush Rebellion, you can call it the Wise Use Movement, you can call it whatever you want, but it's been going on for a long time, and it hit its apex in 2017.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Jonathan Thompson has been a reporter and an editor for the High Country News. He writes about the West in a Substack letter called The Land Desk. His book is a history. It's a portrait of the county. It's also a bit of a memoir. He wanted to understand what it was about San Juan County that had made it one of the main battlefronts in what has come to be known as the Sagebrush Rebellions in the West. We began our conversation talking about borders because he says in the book the location of the boundaries matters because of how powerful they've become.
The so-called Sagebrush Rebels actually put a lot of stock into those lines, those arbitrary lines. Like, they think that if you live within San Juan County, if you live within those lines, that you should have more say over the public lands within those lines than people who live outside of them. And so for me personally, like, I feel a lot differently about it. So my view is that I live in a landscape and this whole landscape is my home and these lines are kind of meaningless. And I think that that's how a lot of other people feel too. And so it becomes this strange thing when you've got San Juan County people saying to the Pueblo people who are now live in Arizona or New Mexico, saying to them, whose ancestors had lived in what is now San Juan County for hundreds, thousands of years, to say to them, you don't deserve a say in what happens on these public lands. And I'm speaking here specifically about Bears Ears National Monument, but about other issues too. You don't have a say, or you shouldn't have a say, because you live on the other side of that arbitrary line. I think the other part of it is contained in the history of the experience of the Mormon white settlers who first came to San Juan County in 1879. And, you know, some of it is actually rooted in why they came in the first place. They did not come to establish a colony and make the desert blossom like a rose, as a lot of other places, as was the case in a lot of other places in Utah, like St. George or what have you. They came, they were drafted by the church. It was 250 people, and they were sent there essentially to act as almost like human shields. These people were sent over to San Juan County to be a buffer between, on the one hand, the indigenous people who they thought might be hostile, and on the other hand, the mining, basically the gold rush that was occurring in southwestern Colorado at the time.
You also mentioned, and this was interesting, that, for example, the Hole in the Rock expedition and the people there that eventually settled Bluff, you know, created Bluff, that because it was so incredibly arduous to get there, that they felt like they were entitled to that land because they had conquered it.
I mean, I think that, yeah, and so there, it's a combination. It's like, on the one hand, we didn't want to come here in the first place. We were sent here. Right. And then in order to get here, it was this terribly hard journey, like this incredibly difficult journey, which entailed building essentially a road into the Colorado River Gorge and then walking across the desert in the wintertime. And then they get here and it was not easy. It was not the oasis it looked like for them. So it was a very difficult landscape and hostile to them. And so I think, yeah, they felt like we got here, we did it, we endured. And so therefore we're entitled to have some control over this place that we see as ours.
Yeah. It's the public lands paradox is how you talk about it. And it's this, you say it's the sense of entitlement that exists there. And that seems to be a really important theme here because, and this was interesting too, you say in the book that this sense of entitlement tends to be stronger among those who live nearest to public lands.
Yeah, I mean, the reason I call it a paradox is because I think that we're all taught growing up in America, especially probably in the West where there's lots of public land, that these public lands belong to all of us. You know, these are our public lands, and it's even on the signs. And I think that that's, you know, there's a reason for that, and it's good. But at the same time, I think that people can kind of take that maybe too far in a sense. And they feel like if it's mine, I can do whatever the heck I want with it. You know, it's mine for the taking. And I, you know, that's true with whether it's a mining company or oil and gas company, and they think it's theirs to exploit. It's true with, you know, a mountain biker who wants to go on ride into a wilderness area or what have you. You know, I mean, it's not limited to the sagebrush rebels for sure.
Yeah.
But I do think it's stronger with communities that live next to those public lands that, you know, we feel, and I say we in this case because I grew up in one of these communities, and I mean, I did feel this sense of entitlement too, which is that it is literally kind of my backyard, and therefore I both have maybe more of a responsibility to take care of it in a way, but also like I kind of feel like a sort of selfishness about it as well.
Yeah. Part of the story you tell in the book is the really the sacking of native antiquities in the region by white settlers and explorers. And I want to come back to that idea here. Before we get there, I want to ask you about the place itself, because you write about how in 1878, there's this surveyor and astronomer, Rollin Reeves, seems like a great character for a biography or something. He comes to, you know, plot out the region, I guess. And I wanted you to maybe say a little bit about Rollin Reeves and say something about something you wrote in the book where you said that the outsiders came with, and this is how you describe it, with the delusion that the entire region was an empty canvas on which they could start anew and build a society from scratch. Which really, I think, Jonathan, gets us back to this idea, this ongoing theme throughout the book. It's kind of the through line of entitlement. Talk a little bit about that.
You know, if you look at early maps, and when I say early, I don't mean like 1776. I mean like 1880 or 1890 or even 1900. A lot of times San Juan County is a blank spot on these maps because people just hadn't gone there enough. The surveyors kind of skirted around it. The Spanish Trail, for example, went into San Juan County on one edge and kind of went up above and around it. So a lot of white people or European people had not seen it, especially people who were surveyors. So it was a blank spot, literally, on the maps. There's nothing there. And I mean, I think that's symbolic of how people saw it, which was they saw it as a blank spot, even though, like, it obviously was not. The indigenous people, again, had been there for thousands of years, had built up societies here, had cultivated crops. But I think that the whole West, that's how the America saw the entire Western United States, was to some extent, this big blank spot where they could come and they could choose a piece of land and have it through the Homestead Act. All they had to do was say, I want it. Or they could choose a piece of land and mine it through the General Mining Act. And then they could they felt like they could do with it whatever they pleased. They could make it into what they wanted. That they really saw it as a blank canvas. And Frederick Jackson Turner, you know, he said things like that in his writing. It was this big gift of empty land where you could kind of realize your dreams or write your dreams. I don't think it's over. I mean, I think that
you don't think that idea is over.
No,
you're still
idea is over. I think still people kind of think that way, and people come to the West. You know, it's a little bit different. I don't think people come to the West to totally reinvent the place, although sometimes they do. You know, people move to small communities, and then they bring their own ideas with them, and they try to reshape it to some extent. But I do think that, in a big way, the West is where people go to reinvent themselves.
Yeah.
You know, like they think that it's this sort of a frontier in maybe a philosophical way where they can kind of reshape themselves, and it's a new place. But it's a strange phenomenon, an interesting one. But it was certainly big back in those settler colonial days, and it's really what I think led to a lot of what went wrong in the ensuing years, and what ended up damaging so much of the landscape and the water and the air and the people.
How important was it for you to include this larger story of the indigenous people who are part of that? I think a lot of times you think about, oh, the history of San Juan County, it's, you know, when the white guys showed up, but you go deeper. Talk about the importance of that.
Well, I think it's super important. I mean, if you just look at like what's happening now, which is the biggest fight of the, or the biggest kind of discussion in San Juan County in a long time has been the Bears Ears debate.
Yeah.
And that's huge, and it's big nationally as well, but the people proposing that are tribal nations. It's indigenous people who are proposing that, and they're proposing it because they want to protect this place that they had inhabited for a long time and that they had shaped as well. You know, I think that's one thing. You know, you look at the landscape and you think of it as pristine or whatever, but there were thousands of people who lived there for, like I say, thousands of years, and built villages and built architectural landforms, what they call roads, Chaco and roads, shrines, crops, fields. You know, there was probably fields all over the place. The indigenous people altered the landscape and shaped it. And what we go there and we see now is the result of that in many ways. So to leave that part out would be, you know, negligent, I think.
Yeah. You write about how part of this public lands paradox is built around this lie that, well, this is how you say in the book, it goes like this: a prehistoric civilization known as the Anasazi inhabited these structures, you know, built this, you know, civilization for a while and then left. But you say that's a lie that is continuing to do damage, because the question isn't why did they leave, because they didn't. Talk a little bit about that lie. That's an important part, I think, of kind of the thinking of some people.
The lie was, the first lie is that these public lands, kind of, we believe that they've always been public lands or something like that, which is not true. They were stolen, in one way or another. But then the other lie in the Southwest, especially, and regarding the ancestral Pueblo people, is that they were this civilization that, you know, grew up and flourished here, and then they disappeared. They vanished mysteriously. And right. Nobody knows why, and nobody knows where they went. The fact is,
and they called them Anasazi for a long
which
time.
Is kind yeah. of a bastardization of a Navajo word, which means enemy ancestors.
Right.
And I mean, it's a lie because we know that, and it has been known for a long time that the Puebloan people, the ancestral Puebloan people who lived in the Four Corners area, moved. They just migrated to other places, and so Hopi and the Pueblos in Zuni, and the Pueblos in New Mexico, Taos. They just moved, like people do, and they moved for various reasons. You know, I mean, I'm sure part of it was climate and drought, and maybe overstressing the land. But another part of it might have just been that it was time to move on. This is well documented. All this movement and this migration is well documented in Puebloan history. If you go to Hopi and you ask the people, you know, a lot of people can say, yeah, I'm from this clan and my clan lived here and here, because this is part of our history. You know, a lot of times it's called myth or legend, but it's the history. And so that's the lie part. And the way it's served people and various people is that if you're on those landscapes, those what are now public lands that you think were abandoned, you say that they were abandoned, that these people vanished mysteriously, then whatever they left behind you can say, well, that doesn't belong to anybody, and it's on public land, so it belongs to all of us. And so therefore, there's kind of this disconnect that happens, and it can, or a detachment between the people who are actually living down in Hopi and stuff and the people who inhabited these places. And by making that detachment, it can sort of free you up to dig in those places, collect potsherds, collect artifacts, or in some cases, even with archaeologists, with the national parks. I mean, for example, Mesa Verde National Park displayed the mummified remains of a person in their museum, you know, for everybody to see for a long time. And I think that if there was a mindset that said, that is somebody's ancestor, that's somebody's great, 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 great grandmother. And that person might walk into this museum. I think that they probably wouldn't have done that. And eventually they stopped doing it for that very reason.
Yeah. It's interesting. You really explored those deep histories of indigenous people of that area. And it seems like this is another strand of resistance and rebellion that's part of the story of the area. You write about the Spanish explorers who came, led a raid into the Diné country to kill and enslave those people there, and how they resisted, how they were clever and, you know, refused to be defeated, continued to resist. It seems like that's part of this larger theme, which was really interesting. I hadn't thought of it that way.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely is. You know, the Bears Ears region, for the Diné, when the Spanish came in and when Kit Carson came in later.
Yeah, Kit Carson, right.
What's now the Bears Ears region and also Navajo Mountain, which is slightly outside of the Bears Ears region, but still in San Juan County, those were the places where people went to hide and where Kit Carson and the Spanish, and actually it was Mexico that was leading these raids. They were like, no, we're not going in there. that's too rugged. It's too remote. Those guys, they can go. And in fact, some of those, the sort of fugitives or whatever you want to call them, they never surrendered to Kit Carson because they were up there by the Bears Ears and they weren't bothered. So, and that's still something that the descendants of those people who are in Utah, a lot of them in the Aneth chapter, they continue to have pride in that fact that they resisted and they still are, I would say, in some ways have that same spirit to them.
Jonathan Thompson, his new book is called Sagebrush Empire, How a Remote Utah County Became the Battlefront of American Public Lands. We'll take a break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
We can't turn the Wasatch Front into California, and we won't do that if we elect good Republicans.
Utah and California have more in common than you might think.
They both have supermajorities in their state legislatures. I'm Emily Means.
And I'm Sonia Hudson. In the newest episode of State Street, we're looking at the supermajority in Utah's legislature and how the minority party can actually make its voice heard.
Find State Street wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The writer Jonathan Thompson is with us today talking about his new book, Sagebrush Empire. It's a portrait of San Juan County. And in it, he explores the deep history of the region, the indigenous people who got there first, and the settlers who arrived with a sense of entitlement about that land. The county has become the center in an ongoing battle over public land in the West. Jonathan Thompson, I want you to take us through the roots of the Sagebrush Rebellions, I guess we should say. And even before it was called the Sagebrush Rebellion, I mean, how far back does this go?
Personally, I think it goes back all the way to the Hole in the Rock Trail expedition. Like, I think that's where kind of it was started, because that's where this sense of entitlement, like we spoke about, that comes from, is just having endured this journey. That's the very, very roots of it. And then not too long after that, something else happened where then by then the Mormons were had settled in Bluff and they had created their colony there. And it wasn't easy. It was tough, but they were there. And then in the late 1880s, a congressional delegation from Colorado, which wanted the Ute tribe basically out of their state, they said, why don't we just make San Juan County into an Indian reservation? And why don't we just send them there and we'll kick the Mormons out? And I think, you know, I think that was another turning point, you know, where the locals in San Juan County were like, what? You didn't ask us. And of course, they never asked the indigenous people before they came, but still, so they're kind of getting their own, but they didn't see it that way. They saw it as like, wait a minute, we live here. This is our home. And that is a sentiment that was echoed many years later by Phil Lyman, who was the San Juan County Commissioner who led the ATV protest down Recapture Canyon. Before he led that, he said, I just want to send a message to the Interior Department that this is our home, that we live here. And, you know, I see an echo, like, and I see that echo kind of happening every time, which is kind of this assertion of self, kind of selfhood or whatever you want to call it, of like, look, this isn't your playground. This isn't your, this isn't the nation's playground. This isn't whatever. This is where we live. This is our home. And I mean, I can relate to that totally, but I think that it kind of can go too far, and it repeats itself over and over, and you see it. So then a little bit later in the early 1900s, the Forest Service was created. And part of the reason that was created is because there were people who saw that the public lands, the public domain, as it was called back then, was getting kind of just destroyed, and there was a free-for-all. And so they said, let's withdraw certain areas so that we can conserve the trees there and we can conserve them and we don't give them away to the homesteaders and the miners. And we can control grazing there. We don't give them to the grazers either. So, and that there was resistance to that in San Juan County. People said, hey, wait a minute, we came here and we built, you know, this hole in the rock trail and we did all this stuff to settle this place. And now you're trying to take it away. You're trying to tell us what to do. And it just kept, it keeps repeating throughout history. In the 1930s, there was this effort to create this gigantic 4 million acre national monument in San Juan County and surrounding counties. Never happened, but it was again like, wait a minute, we don't want to become a national monument.
Yeah. Early Mormon leaders in San Juan County, you're right, suggested that the people there should like, guys, try something more than farming. Let's try ranching.
Right.
And because you write about this, as you describe it, this economic swerve into ranching and how that placed the San Juan County area into this new relationship with public lands and the federal government. Like they weren't always ranchers. That was interesting. Like they took this on. And I found that really interesting.
Right. Yeah. So they came to San Juan County on the Hole in the Rock expedition. They had lots of livestock with them, but it was – They came as sort of subsistence farmers, if you will. And the idea, really Brigham Young's idea, and the whole idea was to create these communal communities, these sort of collective communities that were subsisted, but didn't rely on outside markets, didn't rely on capitalism. It wasn't that kind of thing. You know, it was just like we grow the food we need and we have a nice community and we don't deal with outsiders, basically, which is another part of all this story. But after a while of struggling through this kind of thing, and also at the same time, there were these huge ranching interests from outside of the state, from Kansas and New Mexico and Texas, who would bring their cattle to San Juan County to graze. And so these guys are trying to do their subsistence thing, and they're looking out their back door and seeing, you know, thousands of head of cattle eating all the grass and making big profits off of that. And they said, okay, wait a minute. One of the new presidents of the Mormon stake, as they called it, came and said, you know what, we got to get into this business, this cattle business, because they're making money. And so they got into the cattle business. And once they did that, yeah, like you say, it did create a totally different relationship. Because you can't, if you're a farmer, you can homestead a piece of land and have your farm on your private land. If you're a rancher, you can't do that in the West because you need way too much land. So you have to graze your cattle on the public domain. And when you do that, you put yourself into a relationship, even back then when it was sort of a free-for-all on the public domain, you put yourself in a relationship of being a tenant on government land. And when you do that, then you suddenly become subject to new regulations or restrictions or that sort of things that happen on public land. So if someone wants to come and withdraw part of it to make it into a national forest and restrict grazing, then you're going to be affected by it because you're now a big, large scale rancher. And if someone wants to make a national monument, you're going to be affected by it. So that was a big source of resentment. And the big source of the Sagebrush Rebellion was among ranchers.
Yeah. So national monuments also come into the picture, and you write about this rebellion, which seems to really take hold in the 1940s. So let's get to that moment, that first Sagebrush Rebellion, which, as you say, really sort of gets going during the Jimmy Carter administration. And in the book, you write about a speech given by Carter's Secretary of Interior, Cecil Andrus. This was in March of 1977. And he says some things that people in San Juan County found shocking. They were outraged by. Talk about this speech.
Andrus and Carter both. First of all, they came in right after Congress had passed something called FLIPMA, which is basically changed the mandate of the BLM, the Bureau of Land Management, from being what is snidely referred to as the Bureau of Livestock and Mining to a multiple-use mandate, meaning it's still land, livestock, and mining, but it's also for recreation, it's also for preservation, it's also for scenery and that sort of thing. So that was first. Then Andrus came in, and Jimmy Carter was elected, and Andrus came in, and he said, he gave this speech, that I think it was to the National Wildlife Federation. So it was friendly territory for him. And he said, the days of the Bureau of Livestock and Management are over. We're not going to do that anymore. And the days of what he called rape, ruin, and run are also over. And at the same time, he also said, we're cutting funding to all these planned water projects across the West, which also that made not only Republicans and Sagebrush Rebels angry, that made a lot of Democrats angry as well, because they were counting on these dams and water projects for various reasons. Mm-hmm. So it was a big deal.
Well, you say in the book that they were scared. The people there were scared. I mean, that you had environmentalists gaining strength in the time. Indigenous power movements were taking hold. You also mentioned the feminist movement, Gloria Steinem and Bella Abzug, and they were storming around. And this is how you put it in the book. You say the Sagebrush Rebels felt that their long reign of dominance was coming to an end. So they lashed back. And I guess that's what the rebellion was. It was them sort of lashing out, I suppose.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I think it was definitely reactionary. And it was, you know, the Sagebrush Rebellion in particular was mostly about public lands rules. But I think that it was also about just sort of this idea that white male dominance was fading or was threatened. Maybe it wasn't fading yet, but it was threatened by the counterculture and by the feminist movement and by the American Indian movement. Plus, there happened to be a sort of a cast of characters. Cal Black, who was
Cal Black.
Uranium miner, San Juan County commissioner. He was a state representative for a little bit. He was one of the founders of the what came to be known as the Sagebrush Rebellion in the late 70s and early 80s. Senator Orrin Hatch was part of that. You know, it really gained steam, and it was a substantial movement. And Ronald Reagan, you know, he said before he got elected, he said, "Count me in as a rebel," and he was elected, and he appointed a bunch of Sagebrush Rebels to run the public lands.
You said that the Sagebrush, that first Sagebrush Rebellion, never did erupt into full-fledged violence the way the current version seems to have. Why do you think that is? That's an interesting distinction.
So Cal Black and other people talked. They talked big. Sometimes they said, we're going to go blow things up, or we're going to do this or that. Rarely did you see any of that happening. Mostly it was talk. And a lot of the times the talk came from, you know, he was a county commissioner. He was a businessman. He wasn't going to go do that. And it came from politicians. So, and for whatever reason, it didn't inspire people to go do that. And which is interesting because it was in the 70s when the left kind of, the counterculture on the left, there was a lot of that kind of violence going on in various places, but not from the right. It wasn't until later that that started happening. First with the Wise Use Movement, which was in the basically a reprise of the Sagebrush Rebellion in the late 1980s and early 1990s, once the Clinton administration came in. And then more so even later on. And I think a big part of the reason for that is that originally the Sagebrush Rebellion was kind of confined to they were really focused on just public lands management. Mm-hmm. You know, it was almost like a wonky kind of thing because they were talking about regulations and grazing regulations, all that stuff. Later it became more as it evolved or as it kind of died and became reborn again, it became more and more ideological and more tied up in other things. And that as because of that, it made it so that there was more common ground between that and say the Patriot movement in the 1990s. And then what became sort of the militia movement in more recent or the Tea Party movement during the Obama years, which were more violent and which a big part of their ideology is gun rights, for example. Yeah. That's my opinion, is that really early on it was pragmatic. The Sagebrush Rebellion was that they actually just wanted to change the regulations and make it easier for them to graze their cattle, basically. Later on, it became more ideological. And as it did that, that led to kind of more fanaticism and ultimately violence or threats thereof.
Jonathan Thompson, his new book is Sagebrush Empire. We'll take another break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
KUER is proud to be a listener-supported public radio station. We'd like to thank our community of more than 10,000 sustainers who make a monthly contribution to the station, starting at just $5 a month. Because of your support, all the news, stories, and conversations that you hear are independent, calm, and commercial-free. If something you heard on KUER made a difference to you recently, become a new sustainer or increase your existing pledge at KUER.org/donate.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with the writer Jonathan Thompson. We're talking about his new book, Sagebrush Empire, How a Remote Utah County Became the Battlefront of American Public Lands. Where do you think this rebellion is now? How do you describe where it's been? It's now gone through the Trump administration. It's now in a Biden administration. How are you seeing where the condition of the rebellion is? Because one of the things you write about is after the Reagan administration, the rebellion sort of faded for a while, but not in San Juan County. So what's it like in San Juan County now? What's the condition of the rebellion there?
I think it's changed for sure. I think that after, you know, Obama designated Bears Ears National Monument, and at the same time, right after Trump was elected, and Trump comes in and shrinks it. It wasn't that long after that that the power structure in San Juan County changed radically because it's the county commission, the makeup of it, which had long been two white people and one Navajo person and two white people who were of the Sagebrush Rebel sort of school. And one Navajo person switched to being two Navajo people who were both Bears Ears National Monument supporters and one white person. So that was a huge shift. And that right there was a huge shift in San Juan County. Meanwhile, you know, I think that during the Trump administration, after Trump shrunk the national monuments, I think that really this time the Sagebrush Rebellion kind of did die out or fade away kind of west-wide because Trump was in office and they didn't have anything to rebel against. They had William Perry Penley kind of running the BLM. And then as he was about to go out, then this whole COVID thing happens. And it's been really interesting because from what I can tell, most of the Sagebrush rebels have shifted their attention to mask mandates and vaccines and that sort of thing, you know, including Ammon Bundy. Then Biden comes in and says he's we think he's going to restore the boundaries of these national monuments, and there really hasn't been that big of a backlash to it. Interestingly enough.
Yeah, you're right about that. That's interesting.
You know, and I don't know if that's because people are paying attention to other things. I don't know if it's because people, after Trump shrank it, they felt like they won, and now it doesn't really matter anymore. I don't, it's hard to explain, and I don't think we'll really know what it means until after those boundaries are actually restored, and we'll see what their reaction is. But I feel like it's not going to be that big of a deal. I feel like people there have said, you know what, if it becomes a national monument, we'll be able to probably capitalize off it somehow. It's probably fine. So I think that we're entering a new phase. I also, quite frankly, the Biden administration does not show much interest in clamping down on public lands grazing. I haven't seen anything from that. People are still paying this ridiculously low price to graze their cattle on public lands. So, and you know, the fact is Biden being an old white male is sparks far less backlash and reaction than Barack Obama did as president, you know, no matter what his policies are. And so, I don't know. Right now, it seems like it's in a lull, the Sagebrush Rebellion.
Well, that sort of brings me to my final question for you. You really round out the book in a, I was a little surprised how hopeful you were. You mention the fact that there, you hadn't seen that backlash, at least not yet, to President Biden probably restoring Bears Ears. You say progress is being made. And then in this really lovely epilogue, you write about how the air is getting clearer. Say something finally about that, how you're thinking about all of this, because you really come across as, I mean, you're not, you're aware of climate change and all the terrible things on the on the horizon there, of course. So I'm not suggesting you're being naive, but what I am saying is that you did come away more hopeful than I guess I expected.
You know, part of the, something that's not really part of the whole Sagebrush Rebellion and the public lands wars is that San Juan County is surrounded by, like, literally pretty much surrounded by coal-fired power plants, big, huge, massive polluters. And one of the biggest one, actually, Navajo Generating Station, which is down by Glen Canyon Dam, shut down in 2019. And it's, you literally could see the difference almost immediately in the air quality. And so that's what I write about, is that, like, this was something that, like, that plant was built right around the time I was born, as were the other ones, you know, either right before or right after I was born. So I had lived my whole life, you know, just kind of the baseline air quality was smoggy. And then all of a sudden, 50 years later, one of them, the biggest one, shuts down, and the other ones dial back on how much pollution they're putting out. And all of a sudden, that you can see it in the air quality. You can see things that you couldn't see before, that you didn't even realize existed before, really, in a way. And it was like, oh, wait a minute. You know, things can get better. You know, it can, we can heal the place, even after decades or a century of kind of abuse, healing can occur. And so Now, unfortunately, this last summer, for example, the air was again dirty, not because of the coal power plants, but because of wildfires in California and Oregon. But, you know, so there's also bigger wounds that we still need to heal. But just that, I don't know, that change, it was really remarkable, because really I grew up thinking that those coal power plants, they were never going to go away. You know, we might be able to get them to clean up a little bit or have a little bit less pollution, but they're not going to go away. There's no way. But they are, actually. I mean, they're all slated to shut down within the next decade or so. So I think that there is hope. You know, it just comes, progress comes so slowly. But you got to keep on it and keep trying.
Jonathan Thompson, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Jonathan Thompson, he writes about Western land issues on a Substack newsletter called The Land Desk. His new book is Sagebrush Empire, How a Remote Utah County Became the Battlefront of American Public Lands. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, love to hear from you. We're on Twitter at Radio West. Our intern is Stu Nolan, the program produced by Carrie Watson, by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. I'm Doug Fabrizio.